Hello and welcome back to Distracted Propaganda. My name is Lucas.
And I am Alan.
And you are currently listening to episode 4. This episode, we're going to get into why a lot of music, specifically singer-songwriters and bands, shift to the pop sound.
Especially nowadays.
Yeah, we would say it's happening more now, and there's more pressure to do so now than ever before. So we're kind of going to explore that, and our conversation is probably going to go a bunch of different directions.
Oh yeah. Considering that we both do write, it's gonna we're gonna take in some avenues towards writing and other forms of art, as well as capitalism, because of course.
Yeah, and before we get into it, we did want to do a quick shout out to, we have a few new listeners. We got, I think, 2 Kiwis. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy to say that. I don't know why our podcast is doing so well in that region.
Yeah, also, is it politically okay to say Kiwis?
Yeah, it is. They call themselves Kiwis.
Okay, but just because they call themselves Kiwis, can't we call them Kiwis?
I guess we'll find out.
Okay.
Or we won't find out, because no one listens to any episode after the fucking first one, which is the other thing we wanted to say, which
right, no one not rage.
Is going to hear. Because no one's going to listen to this episode. But people, stop listening to episode 1. It's our worst episode.
It's hard-pressed to say that now on episode 4.
I know, but literally it's our worst episode. It's like we experimented. It took us, I think, 3 hours just to get my mic to work
that day. It turns out it was me that was...
Yeah, and it was you the whole time. I wanted to, like, choke you out so badly. But, yes, so please stop listening to our first episode. It's shit, okay? Okay, it's not... It's maybe not shit. It's just not who we are.
It's shit smelly. It's a little smelly.
Yeah, it's a little Johnny Depp's bedsheets.
Oh, boy!
Anyway,
so yeah, episode 4, Destructive Propaganda. Take a gander, take a listen. We hope you enjoy. What made you pitch this topic?
It's just something I have noticed a lot. And also, there's a couple of things. The first thing is that a lot of bands that I really enjoy, or just singer-songwriters even, will move to the pop sound, and then I just end up not liking them so much anymore. And so I don't think I'm alone in this. There's a lot of people that they start liking a new band or a new singer-songwriter because of their unique style, their unique voice, whatever it is. And maybe they're even playing with a new sound too. And then, like, basically, we love them because of what they have come up with. And then they just end up becoming like everything else we hear. And yeah. So I think that they end up actually alienating their original audience, and they end up being absorbed into whatever the pop audience might be. Like, they actually, I don't think it hurts them. I think they actually get a bigger audience, but the ones they alienate are the ones who really used to love them for their sound that they started out with.
Like their foundational fans, the ones that essentially propel them into fame.
Yeah.
And I feel like that, and I realize if I've heard many stories like that. And there, when you were saying that, like, 2 bands in particular came to my mind that I personally listened to, grew fond of, thought they were cool, and then they started to try new things, and at first they're like, okay, new vibe for you. I'll just name them, like Mumford and Sons was like the first name.
That's one I really liked too, or used to.
Right. And when Wilder Minds came out, when they like really switched to rock, like folk rock, it was this weird in between that didn't really make sense, but it felt like it lost its core identity. Because you listen to Babel, you listen to Sigh No More, those albums, they were great. Like Little Lion Man is how I found Mumford and Sons, and Mumford and Sons was a band I found before Bon Iver, James Blake, and James Vincent McMorrow, the 3 artists, bands, collectives that I personally like the most, or have historically liked since I was a teenager. And some of those, like those three in particular, they've experimented, then they came back to their roots, and they're still experimenting now. I think Bon Iver and James Blake are two prime examples of experimenting that went well. And I think what happens, I can't even say I think what happens, I'm not trying to like speculate here, but I know musicians want to try new things, right? Whether it's to garner a bigger audience, to enrich their current audience and their own music creating experience. And that leads into what we get with Mumford, with Wilder Minds and other bands. Another one I think is Imagine Dragons.
Yeah, I used to really like Imagine Dragons. Same. Actually, I was going to even bring them up as I don't really see their shift to what they were to where they are now as completely like unbelievable. I do see how they went from there to here more mm-hmm. than Mumford and Sons and more than another band I really like, The Head and the Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's one I'll bring up later too, but I can understand how Imagine Dragons got here. Do you see that as a really big shift or kind of like an unreasonable shift?
So Imagine Dragons, I like took pride in listening to them like 9 months before they hit mainstream. And the way I found them was, I think their song came out, and then a couple months after, it was featured in like the King, the We Are the Kingdom, and like that really big for their first big hit.
Yeah.
That was showcased in The Fault, it was either The Fault in Our Stars trailer or The Silver Lining movie trailer. One of those trailers played that song. And that's when I first realized, oh, they're getting big. And then this was like, I don't know, sophomore year, freshman year of high school for us when they started to get really big. And yeah. Then they just sounded, for me, it wasn't like a gradual shift. For me, it was just, I just didn't like their music that they came out with afterwards. And it just fell off my radar. But then the trope kind of came about with Imagine Dragons and the cliche of Imagine Dragons and how they became that quintessential pop zone of that mid-2010s era. And I think before them, the biggest band to have that kind of like generic pop was Coldplay.
Yeah, I mean, Coldplay, and I don't know if they're another one, because I really haven't listened to them much. I don't know if they're another one that really falls under this rule. But I know that with like Imagine Dragons, I think with them, actually, they might have made their own cliche that they don't really break at all. It's hard. Like, I mean, being any kind of artist is really tough because you don't want to keep repeating the thing that you have done before to like keep it lively. But at the same time, like, what if you become famous off of that? Now you've mm-hmm. got to change it. And then you might change it in a way that people aren't okay with, you know, people that really liked you. But I think the issue I see with moving to the pop sound in music, it's not so much that artists are experimenting with new sounds that their original base doesn't appreciate anymore. Because I think if that's all it is, like a bunch of artists just trying to experiment and see what happens, and maybe they have a different vision than their audience had for them. People do have a tendency to be very nostalgic. So when it comes to making something new, people kind of really just want more of the same thing that they're used to from somebody, especially if they don't feel like they got enough of it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that I think would be fine, but I think that there's a bigger drive. There's a big reason why all of these very nuanced sounds ultimately end up sounding similar to one another. And I think that just has to do with capitalism.
Like there's this inherent, like behind the scenes formula. And it just so happens that in the quest to gain notoriety and gain more popularity with one's own creation, they find themselves into this formula, kind of rinsing and repeating what came before them.
Yeah, I think, and I don't remember what these people are called, but there are these, I think they're like two guys or something, but they actually have a literal formula for pop music. And it's a formula that is actually, it's like you can find a certain chord progression in all these pop songs. And for some reason, because it sounds familiar and it's easy to digest, people just kind of eat those songs up. And mm-hmm. there's even another phenomenon, which is kind of weird to me, but a lot of songs that you listen to the first time and you're like, wow, this sounds like garbage. But then they just keep playing it on the radio or in stores, and then you end up actually liking that song because of exposure. But I guess what I'm trying to say is there actually is a literal formula. It's like a money-making formula for music.
I think I heard something like that before, read something like that. It either popped in like a Reddit feed of mine or some other feed where I kind of read into it, and how they're able to figure out, like, out of like the top 100 Billboard's top 100 for like the past 50 years, these are the most likely to pop up. This is the most likely to succeed. This sound, this instrument will do you well. And it's a very positivist and analytic way of looking at music. And I think the comedian Bo Burnham put it best in his show. I think it was Make Happy. And it was the last bit that he did. You just got to make it funny. You just got to make it rhyme, were his words. And if they still don't get it, repeat it one more time. And it's paraphrasing. It is not verbatim. But
did you hear that? Alan just quoted Bo Burnham word for word.
Word. we fall into complacency and comfort. And that we, like you said, like, we like what we're used to, and when artists come with something new, there is a slight expectation in certain parts of the fan base for it to be a similar sound, a similar experience, essentially what they did before again. And it's when artists, maybe artists like try to move out, branch out. They're human, they're creatives, they want to experiment with something new, and they lose a substantial amount of their fan base with this new noise, with this new sound. And in order to regain those lost followers or lost fans, they try to come up with another new sound, but they lose more, and they eventually, like this vicious cycle that they put themselves into, end up in a popish noise that is so generic and so beatified that anyone can kind of come in and out. Their music become a revolving door.
So I think an example of this is actually Ray LaMontagne. Do you listen to him at all?
No.
So he has just this really smoky voice, just a really wonderful voice. And personally, I like music with a lot of texture to it. So I actually don't like the pop sound in general, just because it's too clean for me. So someone like Ray LaMontagne is perfect for me because he has a really textured, smoky voice. But anyway, he made a couple albums. I think he was a construction worker and he was depressed, but he also wanted to be a singer-songwriter, so he ended up making these albums. People really ended up loving his sound. His songs are really sad though, and given where he was in his life, it would make sense. So he gets famous off of the sad music, then he's like, now I'm happy, I'm going to make some happy music. And I don't think he was trying to really, you know, go toward the pop sound so much as just he wanted to experiment with a different emotion. And people just hated, they absolutely hated, like, his original fan base, they just could not stand his new album because I guess they just enjoyed him more when he was depressed. It was really sad, and I don't think that was necessarily him trying to move to the pop sound. It was just him experimenting and failing.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that would apply to, and this is going to be a tangent, but do you think that applies to not just singers and songwriters and bands, but other forms of art, like I think it applies to writing and how, you know, we try to write something we want to, but then through the process of editing, it becomes something that one either was not completely different from what we intended it to be. And it might not be a pop sound, but it's a pop format of text. It's a pop story.
Yeah, I mean, I think it applies to all forms of art, actually. And I think mm-hmm. the big question, because we're really talking about music, but the big question that we're asking is, to what extent does capitalism inhibit art? So like, but I do think it's a little bit different. I mean, I'm not sure.
Oh, really. Yeah. There's going to be nuances for every respective avenue.
Yeah. I know specifically for musicians, though, they just find it so hard to make any money. Like when mm-hmm. when you have a niche fan base, it's so difficult to make a living off of that. And it just becomes a lot easier to make money when your music sounds more pop. So I understand why bands will kind of move to that sound, basically alienating their very niche fan base, but they end up adopting a whole new fan base that wasn't with them for the entire ride and will maybe never appreciate their old music the way their original fan base appreciates their music. But at least now they're a lot better off because they have actually tapped into a bigger market.
And that's what people call sellouts, right?
Yeah, and I mean, they call it sellouts. I honestly don't hate on the artists so much for that. I don't really think it's totally their fault.
And to that, and I mention it because I think it's a good question to be asking, like, they're trying to not just survive. Sure, they're trying to thrive. Sure, they're trying to succeed and gain some notoriety, gain some fortune. But at some point, you know, they have to, if they're a band or a singer-songwriter, fully commits to this endeavor, they're going to need to make ends meet. They're going to need to do what it takes to make money to sustain their life. And then I think the argument of a sellout comes more into play. I mean, even then it's from an outsider's perspective, but I was just even thinking, like, you know, the music is good. Like, an artist's music is good. They're doing well. They're not changing much and they're doing well for themselves. But they got greedy. They wanted more money. So then they decided to change, like deliberately change. And I'd say that's a different example, an outlier that I could see being presented as a counter. That capitalism, I realize that no one can see me make this shape. I don't know what shape. It's like a castle house.
Let the record show that Alan is making a completely fucking useless shape right now.
It's a moving shape.
You look like doing like aerobics.
Aerobics, right? And yes, and jazz hands, and kick. And what a
scene.
And scene. I wonder what the image is of people trying to decipher this in their head.
It's like worse than what you imagine. Whatever
it is. It is a lot worse. It is a lot worse.
Oh my God, put that away. Top. That's gross.
Jesus, it wasn't supposed to be there. I don't. But like capitalism, and going back to the big question of, is it, well, it is inhibiting, to what degree is it inhibiting art, to the point where genuine art, it's definitely to a point where genuine art isn't sustainable, true to self art, the vetting process of it being looked at and presented to the public eye is just way too difficult, is nearly improbable for one's most genuine art to be broadcasted globally or even locally. So it inhibits genuine art. Is it killing creativity? If people growing up now are more aware of the sound, the pop sound, the sound that makes everything popular, to guarantee you an upshot to the top 100 charts. won't that affect people's mindset, subconscious, going into creating music? Won't that, like, that has to affect and influence how people create music? And if that's affecting how people go into playing music and creating music, will we ever get an unadulterated sound from what the artist's original intention is to the listener's ear? And I know, we know there's this process, one, because we want to make sure what's being sent out is refined, what's being sent out is palpable, and not just, you know, someone on hooked on Adderall for like 7 days straight and did their final paper or their draft of their song and be like, this is a song that I made, and it's just this nonsense. That's not the kind of rush job I'm talking about, but the unadulterated, true to form self art that one presents, that's not being showcased, that's not being represented. So people, I don't think, are going to even attempt to try to make an art in their form that is genuine and true to self. If especially going into it and you want to make a name for yourself, people are forced to, or heavily encouraged, societally encouraged, go the route of what's been out before and then break free from it.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a way that I'm not following, essentially, where I don't think it's a way that we're essentially following, but I feel like that is the most efficient, optimal way for someone to succeed.
Well, I think it's like, if you want to just be a musician, like as your day job, you know the game, you know you're going to make a much bigger name for yourself if you get into like pop. But the other thing that's difficult is you can't just start by making pop songs, because who gives a fuck about who you are? There are all these other people that sound just like you do, that we just know their name, so we're going to listen to them instead of you, right? So oftentimes, I'm not saying that they do this deliberately, but it just, I think, makes more sense to come up with your own sound, develop that really niche fan base that will move with you long enough into your, you know, journey into pop, where like they're basically like supporting you as you move into pop, and then and only then can you totally, you know, betray all of them and and just go like straight to pop. Because it won't, like, I don't see it happening the other way, where you just start as a pop singer. I think that might even make it harder.
I think it is. Yeah. I don't think that's how it is. I just think that's how it'll become, or the intentions are going to be more focused in the pop, then there's going to be less niche, I guess, is what I was trying to suggest. But there is one artist that comes to my mind that went straight into pop and just grew from there, and that's Taylor Swift.
That's true.
And
I actually know another,
not a fan of Taylor Swift, was not a fan of Taylor Swift for a long time, but started to open up to her, not gonna lie, like some good music. And yeah, she did collaborate with Bon Iver, so there was that's a pretty big reason as to why I gave Taylor Swift a chance, was because she collaborated with one of my favorite bands. But it's always there's the Taylor Swift trope of, you know, the love song, breakup song. It's like the Imagine Dragon cliche, the Taylor Swift cliche of how she writes about being broken up with and how she's going to leave you for someone better, and she doesn't need anyone. And I'm sounding like I'm bashing the things that she's talking about, and I apologize, not the intention. But we know her history to a relative point, how she came from affluence, how she was funded throughout her whole career. And, you know, it was as good as she is as a singer, as influential as she is as a human being in the echelon of at least American pop stars, there was a heavily financial incentive, or heavy incentive financially, for this,
yeah,
for this endeavor, which succeeded immensely.
Also, just to get into, it's not even just the sound, it's also the content. And mm-hmm. by the way, this is not to bash Taylor Swift, but Taylor Swift talks about breakups in at least all the songs I know from her. I know that she maybe has changed her tune a little bit now, but point is, she, I think, like, basically love, and especially if you talk about love in a context that's painful, so whether it's a breakup or you love someone, they don't love you back.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's gonna, you're gonna hit a home run with that shit.
Yeah.
A lot of the more textured songs that I listen to are about these very specific emotions and these very specific circumstances that I do honestly think are important for people to understand. Cause I mean, like, how many fucking people need to listen to a song about a breakup all the time? It's not the mm-hmm. only thing we go through as human beings. There's a whole array of human emotions and experiences that make up who we are. And most of our music that is like mass listened to are songs about breakups. Albeit, I understand why if you're going through a breakup, you're probably going to want to listen to that on repeat. Whereas when I'm feeling like, I don't know, like, for example, there's a Head on the Heart song, Summertime. It just kind of evokes the feeling of summer. That's all it is.
Right? I know that song.
Oh, you know that? So is that a good description of it?
Yeah, I think so.
So, like, I mean, when it's summer, I don't really need to listen to that song on repeat. But for some reason, when we're dealing with a breakup, people need to listen to breakup music constantly. So I get that. I'm just saying that even the content of pop songs are very limited.
There is pop content. Like, there's pop noise, there's pop content.
Yeah, and they're all in the same mm-hmm. song.
And you get niche, I think. Is there such thing as niche pop content? Or, well, alt pop.
Alternative pop, yeah.
Yeah, niche pop, alt pop. And there is, like, alt pop content. There's punk content. There's country content. There are these things, not just noises and sounds, but also the content, to sound like a broken record, in each of these categories and genres that are formulaic, that don't guarantee success, but will help in one's success or endeavor to success.
So going back to your comment about genuine art, I think that it's really hard for anyone to define it. First of all, there is no definition of genuine art versus inauthentic art. But especially for me, I can only say personally, I see two extreme sides of a spectrum. You've got on one end, the person who thinks that whatever they make is really, really good. And when they show it to you, hoping that you think it's good too, and you say it's actually not that good, maybe you even think it's bad, well, you just don't get it. And so those people, I think, really miss the point, because I do think that art needs to be perceived, especially if you are making it with the intention of people liking it,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they expect you to like it if you understand true art. And so I'm like, okay, well, dude, if you, and I've actually had this conversation with some people before, I'm just like, dude, if you are making this for yourself and nobody else, I can't comment on it. It's, I mean, if you think it's great, then it's great because it's just for you. But you're trying to make art for the world right now. And I'm telling you, it's not, like, it's got some problems.
Yeah.
And you're just like, no, it's good anyway. So then there's, obviously that person is not operating under any influence of capitalism whatsoever. I don't think that makes that kind of art genuine, because they're not considering their audience whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end, the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you've got somebody that's really not interested in creating art that pushes boundaries, pushes thinking, any of that stuff. They're just interested in making something that generates a profit. And they know the things they have to do to generate making a profit. Like, just for example, right? You've heard the song before. You might not be able to name it, but you've heard the song before. Soprano male voice singing about how much he loves somebody, but she's not returning the feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You've heard this song before?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they know, like, it doesn't push anybody to consider a new sound or a new, like, way of thinking about love or relationships. It's just going to work. So just both ends of it. And I don't really think either one's really genuine art. I do think there's like a, you've got to sort of find a middle ground. And I do, I mean, personally, I do think that, so this is the reason why I am not trying to make it as a writer as my day job, because I think at a certain point, if I really am just trying to write because I want to make money off of it, ultimately, it's impossible to escape the thought of like, okay, but how am I going to make money off of this? Like, I need to make money off of this. So I'm lucky. I'm more passionate about teaching than I am about writing, thankfully. But that also really frees me up to write things that I find to be true and genuine, because I really don't care. I still consider my audience, but I don't care about the mass marketability of my writing.
Before we get into, or before I get into the writing aspect, I did want to touch upon, again, the two extremities of quote unquote genuine, or quote genuine, non-genuine, unquote art. And in the one extreme, the first extreme you brought up was the one who does them for themselves and rejects capitalism and does it for their own pure creation to test their boundaries, perhaps maybe to strike a narrative and conversations that they want to. And they, and that sense of art, probably we have to be semantical about it. It's like raw art, maybe not genuine art. It doesn't consider others but self, so it's very raw to form, it's true to form. But then you said this a bit before, of how art needs to be seen. And for those people who, it makes me question if they want their art to be seen. Those kinds of people. And the other end, where I would say manufactured art that is just being pumped out to produce income, that kind of art doesn't really beg the question for it to be respected. So it's a lack of respected art on this end, and on the other end, the lack of genuine. Genuine is a terrible word to use here too. Like the lack of is art meaningful if it's just shared by, if it's not shared? Non-meaningful art versus respected art.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to really qualify something as meaningful or not, but I mean, I think like there have been plenty of things I've written that have just been for myself. I really don't care if it's good or not. Mm-hmm. I just want it to be for myself. Sure, you can maybe call it art, but at the end of the day, I'm not trying to get it seen by people. I'm not like showing it to you, and when you, you know, point out a way it can improve, being like, well, you just don't get it. Like, mm-hmm. people do that shit all the time where they think that they're really deeply personal writing, for example, is like amazing, and they show it to you and you just realize, okay, it's clearly cathartic for you, but it's really not publishable. Like, I don't know what you want mm-hmm. me to say about it. I mean, I'm glad that you got all this out.
So I also wanted to touch on writing a little bit before we go back into music, pop sound, and ultimately to the question we're asking, can capitalism and art coexist? And this goes back to what I was saying before about our initial first part conversation about genuine art and how people may have to make themselves sound like the pop noise before they could do anything more genuine. And we kind of established that, and that's really not the case for music. But in writing, I think it could be said that, at least the way I'm doing it, is that there's things that I've written, things that I've published, but the ones that I want to publish now are getting rejected. And they're pretty conceptually out there. One of them is conceptually out there. One of them, I have a pretty packed section where each sentence is its own paragraph, and it's very fast-paced action scene. And I was really proud of that. I really liked it. And I shared it to a bunch of other people and got decent feedback, trimmed it, edited it, and took that advice and sent it in for publishing. It got rejected twice already. So it makes me think, is this really it? Because seldom do people tell you what you need to fix. And seldomly people will say, this is what you need to edit. This is what we want from your writing. They usually only tell you that once they accept the bulk of your writing. And then the editing process happens. So if you can't even write to the point where it matches the taste profile of whatever publishing house or whatever publisher that you're putting yourself into, you won't even get in the front door. So before you could even get in the front door, it has to mold what you're creating, or what one is creating has to mold already just to fit into the first hole. And from there, it gets twisted and churned to the point where it becomes unrecognizable, or can become unrecognizable for the creator once it reaches to the consumer, once it reaches to an audience. And what I feel is most troublesome for me is the self-compromise, the self-conversations you have to make with yourself and say, do I want to take this out? And sometimes you do, and see, I'll take this out for this submission and see if they take it or not. And that's how you kind of find out, at least for me, was this part that was pretty nuanced and niche really hindering me back? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, so you are always, with any kind of art you want to make, whether it's music, writing, painting, right? You're always going to have some kind of a constraint based on the fact that you are trying to get that thing seen or heard. But I think there's a difference between the publishing company, or basically the publisher not really meshing with whatever you wrote and you having to change it a bit for them, and you just basically, you know, bigger picture, the fact that if you really want to make a killing as a writer, you essentially can't do anything that's too out there, because you just simply, like, you almost need to be mass marketable. And to be mass marketable, you have to take some texture away from your writing. And so, like, there's always going to be a driving force. But I think, so it's not like the thing I'm not trying to suggest is that, what if you were to just take capitalism away, all of a sudden, like, everyone can just make art and right? That's not what I'm trying to suggest. But what I am trying to suggest is that you just have to kind of consider the amount of pressure that's put onto you as an artist of any kind to conform to certain expectations and norms. And under capitalism, I think there's just a heavy pressure, and it's like a very narrow, it's like a very narrow horizon that you're able to really do art in if you want to make it big.
Do you think, this is more thought experiment than anything, this might have no merit, but I'm going to ask anyways. Goes back to, I guess, my initial concept of following the form, following the path that's been walked on, you know, following the sound and voice and the writing of capitalism, the content of pop, making it, and then doing one's own thing. And I feel like that's a thought that a lot of people initially may have had going into it, like, all right, I'm just gonna do a couple songs that are mass marketable, and then I'll sprinkle my own personality here and there. And I am talking about music and how artists design their album. And then as the years go by and as I get a bigger following, I'll be more true to myself and genuine how I initially thought, or how we as a band initially thought when we go further and progress further. And what happens is that the noise that they set out just to be mainstream became the noise that they were known for. And so when they try to do the noise that they, or the sound that they wanted to produce, that they wanted to initially produce, they're so far off from the noise that they've molded themselves into just to fit into that narrow horizon, that initial shape to go in, now they can't get out. Or once they do bring out their new sound, they aren't accepted.
So actually, I think there's an example of this, but in acting.
Mm-hmm. Like typecasting?
Well, no, like the idea that you can start as like a pop artist and then do your own thing that you want.
Oh.
So, and this is kind of weird, but so Robert Pattinson, he started out, I mean, he basically became famous with Twilight, which was mass marketable. Honestly, sorry to bash Twilight, but it's kind of shit. Okay. It's not really that good.
Well, there goes the 18 to 24 demographic, those two people.
Yeah, sorry for alienating our 18 to 24 demographic, but look, okay, come on. The fucking, it's not romantic to watch your girlfriend while she sleeps like a creep in the corner, okay? Mm-hmm. That honestly, the amount of just red flags that people fell in love with because of Twilight was really scary. But anyway, Robert Pattinson, he really started as, he got his fame through Twilight, and then he also did Harry Potter, so that was also a mass marketable movie. But he kind of like just disappeared for a while. He was doing a lot of indie films and kind of like doing his own thing. I think he wanted to experiment, and he just wanted to try other things, and now apparently he's going to be Batman. But the reason I bring it up is just because he did actually start the equivalent of a pop artist, and then like moving into some sort of like indie sound, and then coming back into pop, but sort of like reformed from all the other experiences he's had.
Like Pop Redo or Pop Redux, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we see that in music as well. I think one, for me, they're personal bands for me, but James Vincent McMorrow. If I had to choose a favorite, he'd be top two, an arguable number one in my book. And he was a bit sad boy, lonely boyish, and he helped me out through that part of my life, and I still like his sounds and music. His most recent album was the pop sound. It was a shift to pop. The sound profile in his latest album.
That would have been such a meta album.
It would have been very meta. But you see, he was very folksy. He was very vocal heavy, and he used a lot of those electronic synths, the wave noises, that like weird noise that we don't know if it's a violin string or like a really cool piano chord on an electric keyboard, like we don't know, like that noise Rebel just made, like that. And it's gonna be Rebel cameo episode 4. And oh my God. It's going to be good, because every episode is like, I think every episode sound wise for us is a different texture right now.
That's true. Right now I have the texture of my dog just being a demon.
Just headbutting or something. Pay attention to me. And but like he definitely shifted, and a lot of people did not like it. A majority of his listeners probably were not a fan of it. I enjoyed a couple songs. They were great. Yeah, they were kind of shifty poppy, but it still had the essence of who James Vincent McMorrow is and was. And he was supposed to do a tour this year. It got canceled. And he goes up and says, like, I'm going to focus on music that I want to create, not the music that I have to create. So he's aware, right? James Vincent McMorrow is aware that the noise, that the sound that he produced has shifted to the pop sound, and he has at least this realization, at least publicly facing, saying, this is the sound that I did not want to go to. I recognize the sound, and I'm going to move away from it for my next endeavor. I'm not saying that's something to be applauded for. I'm not saying it's unique. I'm just saying that is not everyone is going to be blindly following this path. Some people will have to sustain themselves and then try to breach away yet again from it.
Yeah, I think that there...
I just want people to know that there's a very awkward pause because Luke is giving the weirdest and most seductive eyebrow raise. There it is again.
No, I was trying to unmute myself and it wasn't working. And I realized that the keyboard and your butthole are in different places.
Oh, so is that the face you make when you're perplexed?
Yeah.
And you don't see it because I'm always facing the other way.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's like
Lucas has a wife. Lucas has a family of dogs in a way, but Lucas has a family.
And yeah, I do. And I think that if anyone actually heard our conversations, they would just think there's like sexual tension between us.
I really want to keep this part.
Yeah, we're keeping it.
Okay.
Even this shit, but keep it all.
Yeah. Okay. We're adding texture. Come on.
Yeah,
let's
add more texture. No, but yeah, I mean, people would literally think that we have a thing for each other, but I don't. Alan does. They don't want to admit it.
Projection.
This is are in love with my genuine art.
Oh my goodness. I'm not the one with a ring on my hand.
Yeah.
I by the way, what I want for you. Yeah?
Genuine art is what I named my.
We're cutting that out. Anyways.
Yeah. So I think that one thing we really have to consider, especially if you're thinking of doing any kind of art, is what are you willing to stomach?
Yeah.
I know that I'm not willing to stomach making anything that I'm not absolutely proud of, right? So I'm not saying that makes me a better person, by the way, than anyone else. Mm-hmm. It's just that I can't do it, so I just won't. And I'm that way with pretty much everything, by the way. I'm really lucky to be teaching at a school that really likes my teaching style, because if they didn't, I'd still be doing it and it just wouldn't be good. So so it's like, that's just how I am. Really,
and we also, you know, we're also not in their position of having to make the decision of like, do I make this music or do I make this music? So like, yeah, we're aware of our place. We're not trying to like speak highly or lowly of people.
Yeah. So, but I mean, someone that does choose to do that, I mean, clearly that person can, they're okay with themselves making something they're not totally proud of. So I think that one thing you've got to consider is if that's something you can even stomach doing. But the other thing that I consider all the time is just the fact that that's even a choice kind of speaks to maybe that, you know, capitalism and the need to make a profit off of everything is, it's kind of like fitting a square peg in a round hole a lot of the times. Like capitalism and art, to me, they just don't really seem to go together, because, you know, like capitalism makes sense for something like, let's say, engineering, right? I mean, those seem to fit into each other pretty well. But then for something like art that is inherently supposed to push people, and I know, like, for example, Kurt Vonnegut, he believed that literature should always have a pedantic purpose, and that basically people should just learn something from all literature, which is why all of his literature has a pedantic purpose. So he did that, so that's great. I think that he's one of the ones that, and this is before our time. Like, if you look at a lot of artists from times we never lived in because we're too young, they were able to get away with that a little bit more. I think now the pressures are even stronger to kind of conform to certain sounds and certain types of writing and things like that. So I guess I'm not really sure what I'm trying to say, but I think that the fact that there's this huge pressure to turn everything into a profit. Nothing can exist, or the existence of anything is not valid unless it's profitable in our society. And I think if you really think about it, that's probably true. I mean, you might not think it's true personally. I don't think it's true personally, mm-hmm. but as a society, it's not valid unless you can make a profit off of it. I mean, that's why you even have people that like feel shame for just chilling on a weekend because they were unproductive. You know, everything has to be either productive or profitable, and ideally both.
Yeah, or some kind of tangible result has to be produced.
Yeah.
It has to be able to become produced if it's not immediate. And I think another thing to look at is how historically, or at least I can't confidently say since antiquity, but for the most part, art in human history has been tied to culture, cultural movements, whether it is combating an establishment. Art has been used for disobedience, like civil, whether it's a revolution, a riot, or some kind of attack on power, attack on authority. Art, music as well, especially music, has been used, and I'm not going to say weaponized because it's not really weaponized. There are examples of weaponized music. I think like national anthems are kind of borderline weaponized songs.
That's true.
But that's a heavy, deep topic. What I was trying to get at with music being attached to culture, and it this isn't anything revolutionary or big brain thought. It's just that music is inherently tied to human culture, human struggle. Work song, I think, is a historically beautiful form created from tragedy, created from immense circumstances. And that kind of art, the art that wasn't intended to be popularized, not intended to be bundled into capitalism. And it goes back to what you're saying, where it's harder now because of capitalistic pressure to perform, not just for the sake of performing, but for the sake of profit, for the sake of tangible effect. And what I guess my whole thing, this whole part, and still kind of like hang on to this idea of is genuine art possible, is that maybe the question I should have been asking is selfless art possible? Because it's a bit oxymoronic. Art that you put your heart and soul into, but it's not for the sake of capitalism, it's not for the sake of garnering an audience or for yourself or to test boundaries, but an art that could be shared, I guess, locally, microcosmically, that brings value to those who are able to listen to it. And that kind of, it's like old school or old tech. I don't know if there's a word for it, where I'm not finding the word for it, where art, at least in this context, music being shared. I think I have a good example of it, like, which was dumb of me for me to say, like, I can't think of a word, but like open mic nights, like, you remember the pub that we used to go to in college?
Yep.
Tuesdays, open mic night, people would come in, majority of them would sing, we would have stand-up comics. That kind of art, like, I think that is even a step closer to a genuine art than any song that we could hear, listen, and look for. I presented art.
Like spontaneous?
Yeah, it's spontaneous. It's presented to you. You don't know what kind of art you're going to get into. You just know it's a form of art. You just know someone's creation is going to be presented to you. And there is just some beautiful noises. And there's just some really cool creations that but you just have to go look and find them. But at the same time, you can't expect to go look and find them because you're not going to find it because you have that expectation. You kind of have to stumble into it. And like that art culture, or that just human culture, is just so cool, so beautiful. And I was glad to experience it. I was glad that we were able to experience it. But it's that kind of feeling, the evocation of feeling you get when you're at like an open mic and you get to hear these artists that you've never heard and probably never hear before. Like, I think that's the kind of feeling that I consider to be like a true form of art.
I do think that that kind of thing is really cool because basically you get people that are into the art of comedy and also who are just open to hearing new comics. Like, in a way, we don't really have that form for like writing that I know of, where it's like a bunch of people who really like good literature just kind of get random literature thrown at them from aspiring writers.
The thing about literature is it's one of the longest standing, and it's one of the oldest forms of art and communication. And so it's such a established medium. And everything, I'm not saying things are playing catch up to it. Things have found their own ways to promote and provoke their medium. Art with art galleries, visual media with, well, everything, and comic with stand-up comics and whatnot. And music with music, going to venues, recording studios, having the web to listen to music. And literature, it's hard to find like a open pen night, but in that pub that we went to, they did have like the rough drafts night, like once a month or something like that, where you'd go in, they'd give you like a one sentence prompt and you have 30 minutes to come up with a story. And you go up and present your story and you could win a prize. And that kind of like flash fiction, I think, is the closest in terms of that readily shareable art form for literature. But there's, I don't think there really is a established or foundational way in which up and coming writers can share their work, because it's hard to give it out before you publish it. There's that rank of publishing that writing has, that writing needs for it to be out and about, that music may not need, where music you could go to open mics and perform, and all you really need is yourself, whatever instruments you may or may not need, and an audience of preferably more than two, right? And that's how you're able to share immediately, this is what I created, this is my art, and this is what I want to send out. Writing, I think, is art because it can't be done in 3.5 minutes, or it's very hard to, unless it's a poem.
Yeah, it's just long form.
It's just not suited for, going to reference last week, it's not just suited for the bite-sized moments that people kind of take in and use that bite-sized moments to take in whatever they take in, judge it, see whether they like it or not, and then either continue to follow what they like or dismiss it and forget it in 3 days' time.
Yeah, I mean, you can have this beautiful story that you like seed all these wonderful things happening and then they happen. You don't get that feeling where you read the climax or the resolution and everything just falls into place unless it's not bite-sized, literally.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you can still have a wonderful bite-sized story. I'm not saying you can't, but you just don't get that feeling of like you've been working with this book for however long and you're like, wow, all of it makes sense now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, the one I'm thinking of right now is The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. Dude, when I read that book and I got to I don't want to say what it is in case I'm spoiling it, but when I got to the climax, that was one of those times where I'm like, holy shit, everything just fell into place. Like, and you don't get that when you can't just read the beginning of The Alchemist in 3.5 minutes and know where that's going to go.
Yeah.
You actually need the longer form for it to mean that much. And by the way, that's one of my top two favorite books of all time. Really? Yeah, that and The Stranger by Albert Camus, my two favorite books. And it's been that way for years.
There's a joke somewhere in there. I just can't find it.
Well, if we need a joke, we can just go back to the shit you made me cut out. I also kind of wanted to pose a question. So there are two things I think are overlapping right now that I don't know how to get them to not overlap, especially with the system we live under. I don't really think there is a way. Mm-hmm. But
before you continue, do you want them to not overlap, or are we okay if they are still overlap?
I think in an ideal world, to make art more true, they wouldn't overlap at all.
Okay. So yeah, continue.
So on one hand, you have profitability and making money. I said, and making money, like they're different. Profitability. And on the other hand, you have how many people actually have access to the art and how many people view it or listen to it. And so those things are connected, right? Like if you make a song, your profits are directly correlated with how many people actually listen to that song. But I can think of, I have a feeling that there are some things that would actually have more mass appeal if they weren't so connected to making money. Because like going back to the head and the heart as just an example, right? I really do think that they could have stuck with their sound and they would have had this portfolio of just wonderful music. And there's Rebel banging into the door again. But they would have had, she's also, Rebel's really into the punk sound. That's why she's on drums up there. So nice. I'm talking about her now. I'm trying to talk about the head and the heart. The head and the heart, I really think they could have sort of like stuck with their sound. They would have evolved, of course. But at the end of the day, I don't think they would have sounded quite so poppy if they didn't need more people to listen to their music so that they can make more money. Mm-hmm. Is that making sense? Like how I see these two things as separate?
Yeah. So at least in the example you gave me, like, because I could see when you said that, I could see like a counter being like, oh, we wanted to sound like this because we wanted to sound like this. And maybe that's just their way of justification. And maybe we are absolutely wrong with our assumptions here. But when making money and accessibility to music or the listening part of music are intertwined, I don't think in this current format, in the way society is structured as it is now, there is a way to unloop these and not make them a Venn diagram and make them these two mutually exclusive, where there could be artists that focus on making money that follow the pop formula. There are artists that will make noise and music from what they want and the niche audience that follow them with the niche noises and sounds that they make. It's not so much that both of these sides are missing something from each other. Right now, both of these sides are so intertwined that by virtue of people listening, you're gonna make money. And by virtue of making money, it's gonna entice, no matter how pure of heart and pure intention that initial endeavor of making music may be, that question has to arise. Do we continue our route? Do we shift our sound to garner a larger audience? And it's not going to be those exact words. It's going to be that hard of a question that they're going to ask themselves, but thoughts like that are going to bubble.
Yeah, I think, you know, part of it is the fact that it's so difficult to make any money just off of one person viewing your thing or listening to your song. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think maybe it would actually be a lot easier to to just maintain your fan base and keep making the sound that drew people to you in the first place. If you made a significant amount more money from individual listens or individual people reading your book, you know, because then you wouldn't, you can at least know that, okay, maybe my art isn't, you know, mass appeal, but it's at least enough to make a living off of and stay true to myself.
Yeah.
And I think the choice that a lot of artists face today is that they just come to a point where they realize that they've got their fan base who loves them and they love their fan base. But at the end of the day, they can't sustain themselves with just their fan base. There's like a cap to how popular you can become. And relating this to us, right? Like, we spoke about this before. There's a limit. We already know this shit. And that's why we're not getting paid for this. We don't expect to get paid for this.
Mm-hmm.
We know for a fact that no matter what we do, the premise of our podcast can only go so far.
Yeah. True.
Like, if we wanted to get more viewers, then we'd have to appeal to a bunch of little incels living in their mom's basements.
Yeah, and like actually commit to an alpha male podcast.
Yeah.
I think it'd be cool one day to see if we could have people join us, because we have friends that are up and coming artists, and we have friends that are supremely talented in that field. So I would like to get like their perspective of how they're juggling this question, the coexistence of capitalism, the need and perhaps want versus the noises and the sounds that they want to make. I think if we were to revisit this, we should consider bringing someone in.
What are your final thoughts? We started with the idea of why are we shifting to the pop sound, and ultimately we're asking the question of, are art and capitalism compatible? Do they hinder art? Do they enable it? What are your thoughts?
I think, so first question, the shifting on the pop sound, it inevitably happens for the most part. And I think it's the more popular one gets, more famous an artist or band gets, the likelihood of shift to the pop sound is greater. Not guaranteed, but greater. I don't have a solid conclusion is, can they coexist? Or they are, it is. But there is a detriment. There is a side that is taking more, and capitalism is taking a favorable advantage compared to the creation of art and how genuine it can or cannot be.
Yeah, I agree with you. I also think that the effects of capitalism on art, the fact that we have a very narrow scope of what can be mainstream pop music, what can be mainstream pop literature, things like that. The fact that there's not that much room for new textures and sounds and things like that, I think it does ultimately just affect our experience of existence, right? Like, I mean, I personally don't really like pop music, but I know that for kids, especially teenagers, the music that they listen to between like 10 and 20, I think, like basically they're, I think the music that people listen to in their late teen years to their maybe early 20s will always have a very nostalgic place for those people. I think that's like actually proven. So when you know, like people have been able to play music for people suffering from dementia, but they play music that they listened to when they were around that age range, and that actually kind of wakes them up a little bit. Like, they start moving. And I guess what I'm just trying to get at is that if everyone just keeps having like these same experiences, like we all listen to the same music, and I think there is something to be said for wanting to listen to music that other people listen to, but also having something that's also just yours and not everybody else's. Like, I don't think it's necessarily a good thing for everyone to have the same experiences, like the same auditory experiences, that gives you nothing to actually share and contribute to that mass dialogue we're having. So I do think that's an effect that capitalism is having on us, where, you know, that music is, or like the music that so many people listen to, is kind of just, you know, void of texture. And it might actually end up, like, later down the line when we get older, right? We're all going to be remembering songs that, like, a lot of pop songs aren't even that good, you know?
Yeah, I think we run into the risk of, if we go this route, there's just going to be a sound generator where it just makes sounds that are nostalgic, that fit the profile of whatever you were at this certain time, at this certain age. It will make a sound profile that mimics that. And it's going to be this endless song. They probably already could. If they, like, were to
with AI, mm-hmm. you could make mm-hmm. a pop song.
Absolutely. I
totally believe that.
And I'm pretty sure there is one.
Next episode, we're going
to... Right. If we find one, we'll put the link in the description for you to test it out. Because there is that website, This Person Does Not Exist, and it just generates a very real face, but that person does not exist. And I think music might end up in a similar vein.
I do think the This Person Does Not Exist one probably takes more effort than a pop song generator from AI. Mm-hmm. You literally just have to plug in that formula. Yeah. I don't know. I guess my takeaway is just that it's kind of sad that the music that is going to become so nostalgic to all generations moving forward is just like carbon copies of the same thing. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not trying to sound like I'm like hating on the music itself. It's just that I think that it's a good thing to have a wide array of tastes and kind of be exposed to a lot of different things. And with, you know, like with pop music, it's really difficult to. And actually, there's in Minnesota, there's a radio station called The Current that they are completely funded by patrons, like people that listen to them. So they do not, they've gone a different route where they refuse to make money any other way than donations from you know, subscribers. And that actually allows them to play a lot of cool new, like, new music that's coming out that's really good, that isn't necessarily pop music. But the only way they can do that is by not succumbing to that pressure.
And I was just going to say something like that. Another one part that we may not have touched upon too much, but I think is very prevalent, is what is, because the searching of music, finding that niche is all on the listener. It's all on the person to find out what they don't know about themselves and what they like about themselves that they don't know just yet, and to find their music. And in some way, shape, or form, we've all been able to do that and find our sound. Or a good majority of us have. I found mine because of my history in dance. People found theirs because of maybe their workplace, because of a club or social activity. But if people aren't doing as much as that, and all they hear is the mainstream, I don't want to say mainstream media, but it is mainstream media. Radio is mainstream media. What's on TV is mainstream media. So if all you get is that, all you get is the pop sound, the pop content, none of that is curated for the viewer. It is curated by who is essentially
the man
funding all this. What if we like end this one kind of quietly?
Like we just keep talking about lowering our voices slowly.
Oh, that'd be pretty funny. That's kind of funny. I don't know if like we should, but if we kept going lower in our voices, how low do you think we'd have to go before either of us can't hear each other?
I don't know.
Okay.
Can you hear that?
Yeah, but like kind of softly. Can you hear this much of my voice?
Yep.
So if I go any lower, I have to go.
Wait, we don't have to do this shit. You have GarageBand.
Oh yeah, I could.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude episode 4 of Distracted Propaganda. And now it is my turn to give you guys surprise news. And just like Lucas was saying, our podcast has always been a red herring. I believe we waited long enough. Alongside last week's announcement that Lucas made of Lucas and Alan's Hens and Cocks and Hoes, we would also like to announce Alan and Lucas's cream barn, in which we will cream anything you bring, edible or not, and we'll cream it and fill it to the brim. We'll cream your milk, we'll cream your bacon, baby tomatoes, we'll cream them. Lemons, creamed. Onion cream, you bet. Snacks, cream them all. Lettuce, every layer with cream. Even toothpaste, we'll fill your toothpaste and give you cream toothpaste. Avocado toothpaste, even guac toothpaste, we go the extra mile. Extra sharp cheddar, we'll make that cream and cream it for you. Green pepper cream, potato cream, garlic cream, ground beef, you cream it. Cream chicken, you bet. Individual mushrooms, creamed to the brim. We'll cream your pies for you. Bring your pies and cream, fill them all the way. We'll cream your pies to the brim, to the max, and you won't ever have to worry about any of your creaming needs again. So come on over to Alan and Lucas Cream Barn, right next to Lucas and Alan's Cocks, Hens, and Hoes. So just like Lucas said, starting next week, our podcast is going to be about hens, cock, hoes, and cream-filled objects. I can't wait. Can't you, Lucas?
I'm already there.
Okay. Well, this was fun. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again so much for joining us. Tune in next week when we will be talking about globalization, and we'll have some exciting announcements for our future of the podcast that we'll announce next week as well. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Alan.
And I'm Lucas.
And this has been Destructive Propaganda. We'll see you guys next time. Thank you.